A lot of sound, a lot of healthcare fury, signifying, well, we don't know what yet exactly, do we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 23rd of March. Good to have you with us, everybody. Here is what we know about the healthcare bill. Right? No vote today, maybe a vote tomorrow, depending on whether you listen to the White House or to Republican leaders in Congress. There are a zillion moving parts on this thing, obviously, many of them political, more than a few of them economic. Let me play a piece of tape here. It's of the conservative House Freedom Caucus Chairman Mark Meadows as negotiations dragged on this afternoon.
If we can make sure that there is an adequate safety net, that pre-existing conditions are taken care of, where truly premiums start to go down for moms and dads, that's what it's all about.
It's that last bit, premiums going down, that we're going to look at this afternoon. One of the things on the table to get Meadows and his conservative colleagues on board is getting rid of the Obamacare requirement that virtually all insurance policies cover what are known as essential health benefits. It's stuff like hospitalizations and mental health care, prescription drugs, stuff like that. You get rid of that, though, and the very nature of the health insurance market changes. So Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein gets us going with this look at the healthcare industry a la carte.
Before Obamacare, it was pretty much the Wild West.
Well, any kind of plan could be out there.
John Gruber's an economist, one of the Obamacare architects.
For example, a plan which says that it'll pay for 5 doctor's visits a year for free and cover nothing else. Or on the other side, plans which say it won't cover anything until you spend $20,000. To be clear, I'm not making these up.
Today, when a consumer buys insurance, they're guaranteed certain coverage. If Republicans blow up these benefits, actuary John Bertko says consumers may choose stripped-down plans. The problem? People can't predict when they'll really need financial protection.
You have about a 1 in 5 chance of having something expensive happen to you. So, you know, if you're playing the odds, 4 out of 5 isn't bad, but that 1 in 5 means that you're going to have something terrible and very expensive happen to you.
But to a group of hardline Republicans, this is about freedom of choice, and requiring certain benefits defeats that. Right now, some Republicans are grumbling that single men must pay for maternity coverage. Deregulating insurance, they argue, gives consumers something that'll better fit their needs. But that is not how insurance works, says Gruber.
Insurance is not like cars, okay? If you have a car that's tailored for one group, that doesn't make other cars more expensive. Insurance is linked through one risk pool.
What that means, says Gruber, is if you tailor insurance in an a la carte way, premiums will be jacked up on the sick and the old. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Here is a very jargony phrase for you, brand safety. It's why some big money advertisers are pulling their ads from YouTube, some big European brands, and now American companies like Johnson & Johnson, AT&T, and Verizon have suspended advertising on YouTube because it turns out nobody wants their ad for toothpaste or cell phone services running in front of offensive or extremist or hate-filled videos. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that one.
This very public showdown between YouTube and its advertisers?
I think this is a symbol of our times.
Sinan Arwal is a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. YouTube, like other social media, is being tugged. These are platforms built for free expression, and they're coming to terms with the unpleasant fact that sometimes that expression is really, truly offensive. Some might call it dangerous. Nicole Ames is a digital marketing consultant.
It's sad that it may take the advertisers revolting to get their attention on this, because this is where it's going to come down to dollars.
Google has tried to eke its way out of the standoff with advertisers, promising new safeguards, better controls over where ads appear, more oversight. But so far, companies don't seem to be buying it. Brian Weiser is an analyst at Pivotal Research.
They need to make public statements indicating that the correct answer is zero, as in zero tolerance for providing brand unsafe environments.
Which, he says, considering the massive amount of content on YouTube, could be an expensive proposition. But it turns out advertisers are in their own bind here. James Dix is an analyst at Wedbush Securities.
YouTube has a lot of younger audience.
And that younger audience, in the long run, will be pretty irresistible to a lot of major brands. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
We're going to get back to our series on NAFTA here in a bit, but here is another story from the Marketplace desk of, yes, Virginia, it is a global economy. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Apple is going to start assembling iPhones in Bangalore, India, within a month or two. India is the world's second largest smartphone market and growing fast. It is just what Apple needs if it wants to keep growing. So the upside is big, but it is not without some hurdles, as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
When it comes to big, untapped markets, like what China once was, Apple's running out of places to go. Neil Modson is Executive Director of Strategy Analytics.
There are very few markets left where Apple iPhone can make a serious difference to the bottom line.
And smartphone shipments to India were up 18% last year, compared to 3% globally.
India is really the last remaining piece in the jigsaw puzzle.
But it's not just there for the taking. Apple has a price problem, says Tarun Pathak, an analyst with Counterpoint Research.
iPhone is almost like 4 times more expensive than the average price of smartphone in India.
iPhones there cost about $525, and most of them are older models. Pathak says assembling iPhones in India could bring the price down by $100 or so. He says right now, Apple has less than 5% of the smartphone market share, but it also has something else.
People go crazy to buy this brand.
He says part of Apple's strategy is to bring buyers in with cheaper models.
They want to make it more and more affordable so that once the people get locked onto their ecosystem, they will eventually upgrade.
Still, Apple will face some steep competition, and not just from big international players. Again, here's Modson.
They're also competing with local Indian players with strong local Indian marketing.
That's why Apple's long-term plan is to manufacture in India and open retail stores. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, surprisingly tame, actually, given the congressional chaos. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. There has been no shortage of conversation about that deal last year and this. A lot has been made in all of those conversations of the manufacturing jobs that this country has lost since NAFTA went into effect in 1994. 6 million jobs is the number often bandied about. But which of those losses were actually caused by NAFTA? Or, in other words, what would the world have looked like if NAFTA had never happened? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that thought experiment.
This is a what-if scenario, or if you're being fancy, it's a counterfactual. But really, it's the George Bailey question from the classic movie It's a Wonderful Life.
I suppose it'd been better if I'd never been born at all.
What'd you say?
I said I wish I'd never been born.
What if in 1994, NAFTA were never born? What would have happened to American factory jobs? Now, we don't have a low-ranking angel named Clarence to reveal this to us, but we do have professors, who do find the evidence awfully telling. Mauro Guillen at the Wharton Business School at Penn says a big job-killing wave would have hit anyway. Machines.
There is an element of truth that free trade has destroyed jobs in American manufacturing. But most of the jobs, up to 80%, have been destroyed by technology.
You know the story. ATMs replacing bankers, robots displacing welders. Automation is a very old story, but it has really picked up the last couple decades, and we're all endangered.
We economic developers have an old joke.
A few years back in North Carolina, Charles Hayes at the Research Triangle Regional Partnership put it to me this way.
The manufacturing facility of the future will employ 2 people. One will be a man, and one will be a dog. And the man will be there to feed the dog, and the dog will be there to make sure the man doesn't touch the equipment.
Ouch. But in fact, software replaced workers in the course of reporting this very story.
Hello.
Hi, Scott.
Yes, this is. Is this Scott?
Yes, Scott Tong at Marketplace. How are you?
I have to admit, this tech looks pretty cool. I've never seen it before, but you sound great, and hopefully this will record well and read well on the radio.
I interviewed political scientist Cullen Hendricks at the University of Denver, and I recorded him with a cell phone app. That's it.
This interaction between you and me over this app probably would have involved at least one staff person setting things up or a recorder to make sure that it was captured, right? All of that's been lost to automation.
Which has nothing to do with trade or NAFTA.
We are in the midst of a sea change driven by technology that is radically altering the face of the U.S. economy. And clobbering Mexican workers is not going to solve that issue.
There's another big force affecting manufacturing jobs that also would have struck even if NAFTA had not been born. And that is China, says Wharton's Mauro Guillen.
You cannot rewind history. You cannot go back. But I think regarding NAFTA, if NAFTA had not taken place, I think that the American companies that decided to invest in Mexico would have probably decided to invest in China.
To save money and to stay in business, the impact of Chinese sewing machines and other machines and people operating them has far outweighed that of Mexico's. UC San Diego economist Gordon Hansen co-wrote a defining study on what's called the China shock.
NAFTA gets blamed for a lot of ills in the U.S. economy, and I think unfairly. Mexico's production capacity just isn't that big.
China, by contrast, its economy is 9 Mexico's, and its exports are 6 Mexico's.
The China effect overwhelmingly dominates. And it's not hard to understand why. You know, the growth in Chinese manufacturing exports has simply been stupendous.
But again, most believe outsourcing has been swamped in the NAFTA years by the job-killing effects of automation, machines, software. Yet somehow it's unsatisfying to blame an electron. George Mason University economist Brian Kaplan is the author of The Myth of the Rational Voter.
Human beings tend to blame who they dislike for their problems. Right? So if you stub your toe, like, who do I dislike that I might possibly blame for this? And in particular, what's very striking is they tend to be foreigners who are more different from you. So it's very rare that we go and talk about Canadians taking your jobs.
Which happens, by the way. But back to NAFTA and the George Bailey question from the movie. If the trade deal were never born, it seems evident that not much would have changed. The jobs would have left Bedford Falls anyway. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Who do you suppose was the first president to talk about the idea of NAFTA? We've got the answer in a video on our Facebook page. Also, we'll be on Facebook Live tomorrow. Your questions about our coverage of NAFTA and the deal's future, 10 a.m., 10 o'clock, Pacific Daylight Time. Why is Silicon Valley so awful to women? That's not me. That's the cover story in The Atlantic magazine this month. It draws on a long, long history of sexism in high tech and in Silicon Valley in particular, the most recent example being those high-profile allegations against Uber. Liza Mundy wrote the piece. Liza, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
The answer you get from tech companies, or, well, let me be fair. The answer you used to get from tech companies when you said, why don't you have more women, is there's none in the pipeline. Women aren't studying this stuff. How are we supposed to do that? Is that still the case?
Well, you know, it's still the case that women are not represented in computer science at the levels that they are in other sciences. The number of women going into many other areas of study in the science has gone up. It's gone down in computer science, but some of the major computer science programs like Stanford, mm-hmm. like Harvey Mudd College, have significantly upped their number of female computer science majors. So it is changing. And many of the big companies in Silicon Valley that are extremely attractive places to work really should be doing better than they are and really should be able to attract, I would say, a disproportionate percentage of the pipeline, and yet are not.
Are they? Is it trying to change? Do you take them at good faith?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that companies would like to change. Many of them would and are looking for different kinds of fixes. But I think, obviously, the desire for change varies across the board.
Yeah. Is tech different than, say, I don't know, law or getting a PhD in ancient European history or something?
One of the disparities in computer science is there's really interesting social science showing that fields that fetishize genius and brilliance are like harder
innate,
for women.
Innate genius, brother? Innate?
Innate genius. That there's this... there's this tendency to hang on to the idea that men are more likely to be born brilliant, and that fields like computer science and also math and philosophy that sort of fetishize this idea about the importance of genius and brilliance are harder for women and for people of color to make inroads in because of this kind of stubborn idea that, you know, men or white men are more likely to be geniuses. And I think that's really interesting body of research, and it's not true.
All right, so the idea you just alluded to there about unconscious bias, and the fact also that I interrupted you during that question, gets me to this next question. Well, a lot of people are going to hear that, and they're going to go, oh, Kai, you moron, you're interrupting the female interviewee, right? And that's part of this next question, which is the exploration of unconscious bias in Silicon Valley has now been raised to both a profitable but also very necessary art form.
Exactly. So there's a really interesting, I mean, many, many studies now showing that in tech, as elsewhere, women are more likely to be interrupted in meetings, more likely to have their ideas dismissed. As in other fields, you know, when women become parents, they're seen as less committed to their work, whereas men are seen as more committed to their work when they become parents. And just as you said, it's becoming a profitable industry for consultants, diversity consultants, to give unconscious bias or implicit bias presentations. And the danger is that if a company has something like that once a year, it sort of looks good and sounds good, but it's not going to change things, and it might actually make things worse.
What happens then, do you suppose, if – not that they don't fix it, right? Because you have to assume just – in the course of time that this will get fixed and ameliorated. But what happens if it takes a long time? What happens if it doesn't get fixed fast enough?
What happens is women get shut out of one of the most exciting, attractive fields to work in. Will tech itself be affected? Will the products be somehow less desirable? Some would make that argument.
Liza Mundy has the cover story in the Atlantic magazine. It's called Why is Silicon Valley So Awful to Women? Liza, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
$16 an hour wages are not bringing in native-born Americans yet.
Farm jobs are plenty, but the workers are few. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 4 points today, closed at 20,656. NASDAQ down 3 points, 5817. S&P 500 off 2 points, 2345. Not even worth mentioning, really, for any of those guys, the tenths of percents. Alphabet, parent company of Google and YouTube, lost 1.1%. We told you about that whole ad thing. Apple soured about 1/3 of 1%. Microsoft down 0.25% today. PVH, owner of the Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger brands, jumped 8.5% today on better-than-expected fourth-quarter profits and sales. Coach up 0.9% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.42%. And you are listening to Marketplace. All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they are going to love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, or anybody you care about. What podcast would they really, really like to hear?
All right, you got that person in your head? Now go do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them how to download them. Please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y pod. And thanks for spreading the word.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're going to take a couple of minutes here for our Every Now and Then series. It's called My Economy. You tell us your economic story. We put it on the radio. Today's dispatch comes to us from Tucson, Arizona.
My name is Martha Rast, and I teach therapeutic art lessons. It's way better than cool. It's the best job in the world. I love it. Any kind of therapeutic experience really has to be human to human, because the one thing machines cannot do yet, and I don't think they ever really will, even if there's AI, you know, is really truly understand emotional intelligence. I basically made up the job, right? Because I've been teaching for like 27 years, and I started out in public school. I looked at my take-home pay and thought, even if I do this for 32 years, I'm not going to really do this job for money. I'm going to do this job for, like, spiritual appreciation. In fact, many of the caregivers in the nursing homes that are working around me do not have health care. The irony kills me that they're caring for all of our elderly and they themselves do not have health care. It's absolutely unaffordable. There's no way to slice it. You know, I just want to do my job, but I don't know how much longer I can do that and remain stable.
Martha Rast out of Tucson, Arizona there. Take a couple of minutes, if you got them, and tell us about your economic day-to-day. There's a spot you can do that. It's at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Part of the stated logic for President Trump's crackdown on undocumented immigration to this country is to free up more jobs for citizens. Turns out that's not actually what's happening. Case in point, grape growers in the California agriculture industry who can't find citizens willing to do that hard work, even with the promise of rising wages. Natalie Kitchweff covers the economy for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about this guy you met. Trump voter Jeff Klein used to farm grapes.
So Jeff Klein is a farmer in Stockton. He is still farming grapes, but he used to farm more of them.
Yeah.
Last fall after the harvest, he ripped out hundreds of acres of Chardonnay grapes that his father had planted years ago. So this wasn't an easy decision, but he's facing a ton of competition for laborers. And that's something that a lot of farmers are saying is going on. For Jeff, the result was that he is getting out of the grape business, essentially. He's being priced out of the market. His solution is to switch from grapes to almonds, which require a fraction of the human labor.
They're just easier to farm, right? You shake the tree and the almonds fall and you call it a day, right?
Yeah, basically what farmers told me is 3 workers per 500 acres, which is...
Yeah. You point out a disparity between Jeff Klein's farm in Stockton and grape farmers, which is in the Central Valley of California, and grape growers in the Napa Valley, where farm worker wages are at like $41,000 a year with benefits and the whole deal.
You know, the grapes grown in Napa, as any wine enthusiast will know, they go into bottles that sell for hundreds of dollars. In Stockton, the grapes don't produce wine that sells for that much. Mm-hmm. So there's a natural limit to what Stockton grape growers can pay their workers.
But the point being, native-born Americans don't seem to want these jobs.
Right. Even in Napa, $16 an hour wages are not bringing in native-born Americans yet. That's been the experience.
Has to be said that this immigration tightening started under Obama. I mean, it's Trump's big thesis here, but they did start under President Obama.
Obama tightened the border. He ratcheted up deportations. He made it a lot more expensive for Mexicans to cross over, and that slowed the flow of immigrants into this country.
Given that we're just now seeing the payoff from the Obama-era tightening of immigration, it will be a number of years, right, before we see the full effect of whatever it is that Mr. Trump is going to do.
You would think, although farmers that I talk to are telling me that they're already seeing workers scared to come to the fields, and they've seen a tightening of their own labor force within these first few months. And so, I mean—
Which is unrelated to market forces, right? That's a political forces kind of conversation.
Yeah, that is a by design— political result. You know, word travels fast in these communities. And even if a policy is kind of hasn't even been put into place yet and is really just at the conversation level, you can see a kind of economic effect on the ground almost immediately, because what we're talking about is, you know, humans who get in their car every day and have to drive sometimes long distances to get to work. So imagine if you're undocumented, what the risks are. So that's a decision that people are making right now, and farmers say the effect is already underway.
Natalie Kitroff writes on the economy for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today brought to you by the General Services Administration. Today, the GSA, the federal government's landlord, in effect, said that the Trump Organization is in compliance with its lease on the old post office building in Washington, in which the Trump Organization has built a hotel. That lease, remember, said no officer of the government can profit from the terms of that lease. The GSA said today, never mind. Political Washington went crazy today. Wall Street just kind of said, man, the Dow off just 4 points, NASDAQ down 3 points, S&P 500 off 2 points. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Christy George, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.